There is something about the institution of marriage which still strikes at the hearts and minds of some heterosexuals as something which is just a big social institution that can't be changed.
Oh, bad news, we lost. I was frustrated and angry and sad. And I think the thing that hit me the most is I took it a lot more personal than I thought I would.
It's more important for you to be who you are than to try to be what you think other people expect you to be.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucy Chappelle. Australia's opposition throws marriage proposals into the plebiscite mix, TV's Gay Asian gets away with visibility, and a disappointing defeat derails Canada's queer decade. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending September 3rd, 2016. The Australian Parliament opened its 45th session on August 31st with Liberal Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's Conservative government in coalition with the farther-right Nationals, holding a razor-thin one-vote majority following July's national elections that saw gains by opposition parties. Before he unseated his party's staunchly anti-marriage equality PM, Tony Abbott, Turnbull had publicly opposed a national plebiscite on the issue. But in order to win the backing of the National Party in his coalition government, Turnbull backpedaled to support the popular vote on whether or not civil marriage should be open to gay and lesbian couples.
Australia's leading opposition Labour Party, along with a farther-left but significant majority Greens and a handful of independent MPs, have joined forces to oppose the $160 million plebiscite, charging that it's a waste of taxpayer money to hold a popular vote on the issue when polls consistently confirm that civil marriage equality enjoys the support of more than two-thirds of the public. They also object to the plebiscite because, as proposed in the legislation to formally approve it, even if the expected overwhelming majority is in favor, MPs will not be required to ratify those results when they vote on a civil marriage equality bill to follow.
Labour Party leader Bill Shorten hinted during a press conference last week that his MPs might join the Greens in officially opposing the plebiscite. A Labour-Greens coalition, along with three independent MPs who are on record as opposed to the national vote, could scuttle the plebiscite before it can even be held. Meanwhile, Labour, the Greens, and two independent senators each introduced competing bills this week to legislate marriage equality. Prime Minister Turnbull's approval rating has plunged even further since the July 2nd national elections. 52% of those surveyed this week by the Australian newspaper disapprove of the job Turnbull is doing, up 5 points since the elections. He has nevertheless refused to back down from his support for the civil marriage equality plebiscite that might now never be. He's also refused to give his government's MPs a free vote on any civil marriage equality legislation.
Bermuda's Supreme Court has agreed to hear a civil marriage equality lawsuit. In an August 31st report, the island nation's Royal Gazette newspaper quoted attorney Mark Pettengill, who represents Winston Godwin and Greg DeRoche, that he and his clients look forward to the full hearing of this important human rights issue. The country's former attorney general is representing the couple pro bono. The case grew out of the refusal of the registrar general to process the couple's marriage application. The lawsuit argues that the denial violates provisions of Bermuda's Human Rights Act. In his refusal letter, the registrar cited Section 15 of the Matrimonial Causes Act, which stipulates that a marriage is void if the parties are not male and female. A date for the High Court hearing has yet to be announced.
The highest court in New York has expanded the definition of parenthood by deciding that separated same-gender couples each have the right to seek visitation and custody of their children, even if they aren't the biological or adoptive parent. The state's Court of Appeals ruled on August 30th that the existing standard requiring a biological or adoptive connection had become unworkable in light of society's increasingly varied familial relationships. The decision settled two separate cases involving estranged lesbian couples in which the birth mother had custody but refused to allow the non-biological parent visitation rights. The ruling only impacts cases where the non-biological or adoptive parent was part of the decision to raise a child. The court noted that rulings in future cases would also continue to be based on what is determined to be in the best interest of the child.
The BuzzFeed news site updated two other U.S. LGBT rights-related cases this week. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has already led two separate lawsuits filed by several states against the Obama administration's guidelines on equal treatment for transgender people on school campuses and in healthcare. He and 10 other state attorneys general and two governors weighed in this week on the ongoing battle over the anti-trans provision of North Carolina's notorious HB2. In addition to forbidding local governments from passing LGBT anti-discrimination ordinances, the law requires trans people to use public restrooms that correspond to the gender on their birth certificates rather than their gender identity. Paxton and company this week asked U.S. District Court Judge Thomas Schroeder to put the Justice Department's lawsuit specifically challenging the trans part of HB2 on hold until lawsuits opposing other parts of the law proceed. Schroeder issued an injunction last week ordering the University of North Carolina not to enforce the so-called bathroom provisions of HB2, but it only applies to the students and employees of the state's university system who have filed a separate lawsuit against the anti-trans part of HB2.
The legal papers filed this week by Texas and the others asked the judge to delay any further actions until an appeals court can rule on a challenge to last week's injunction involving the University of North Carolina student and employee plaintiffs. The filing also cites the case of a transgender student who successfully challenged a Gloucester County, Virginia school board policy requiring him to use separate restroom and locker facilities. The school board officially asked the U.S. Supreme Court this week to hear their challenge to an appeals court ruling upholding Gavin Grimm's right to use the boys' bathroom. That appeals court ruling is already on hold, which will force Grimm to continue to use separate facilities as the new school year begins.
In other news, the Church of England has its first openly gay bishop. Nicholas Chamberlain, the Bishop of Grantham, went public before a newspaper that had threatened to out him could publish a story about his sexuality. He told the Guardian newspaper this week that it was not my decision to make a big thing about coming out, but it's not the first thing I'd say to anyone. Sexuality is part of who I am, he said, but it's my ministry that I want to focus on. Chamberlain was consecrated last year, and his sexuality is not a secret. The church's titular leader, Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, said that he's been fully aware of Bishop Nick's long-term committed relationship. His appointment was made on the basis of his skills and calling to serve the church in the Diocese of Lincoln. He lives within the bishop's guidelines, which require him to be celibate, and his sexuality is completely irrelevant to his office. Bishop Chamberlain himself describes his relationship in terms most anyone can understand, telling The Guardian that it is faithful, loving, we are like-minded, we enjoy each other's company, and we share each other's life. The news is, however, expected to get a chilly reception from Anglican congregations in the Southern Hemisphere. Traditionalists there have long threatened to leave the Church of England over what they perceive to be creeping pro-gay acceptance in the denomination. Cure-peddling U.S. evangelicals have inflamed anti-gay sentiment among Anglicans in Asia, Latin America, and parts of Africa, particularly Uganda.
Spanish LGBT advocacy group Acropoli has lodged a complaint with Madrid's regional government against a cure-peddling therapist who claimed in a 2014 interview that heterosexuality is already in each individual. You just have to find it inside. Change therapy is the means to discovering it. The website of psychotherapist Elena Lorenzo Rego claims that everyone is born heterosexual. Her pitch includes testimony from patients she claims to have cured. One man says that he'd had sex with more than 200 men, but that after treatment, he was happily married with a daughter. Acropoli filed the complaint against Rego under Madrid's new anti-homophobia laws that came into effect in August. The group said in a statement this week that therapies that claim to heal homosexuality are false and unscientific and only serve to play with the insecurities of people that suffer not because of their homosexuality, but because of the homophobia that exists in society.
And finally, queer pride has reached the hometown of infamous Moorhead, Kentucky, County Clerk Kim Davis. 2 months after the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 civil marriage equality ruling, Davis attracted global attention for refusing to issue marriage licenses to lesbian and gay couples because of her religious beliefs. She became an instant celebrity in evangelical circles. Davis was eventually ordered to allow employees in the county clerk's office to issue licenses to same-gender couples, albeit without her official signature. David Moore organized Moorhead Pride, the first ever such event in eastern Kentucky. He told the Vice website that the Kim Davis controversy helped push the town's residents to decide where they stood on the issue of gay rights. Moorhead's tourism board was among the Pride event sponsors. About 50 vendors, including nonprofits, had booths at the festival. While the real Kim Davis was nowhere to be seen, a dead-on lookalike emceed speeches by Kentucky's successful marriage equality plaintiffs, a reading by 16-year-old budding transgender poet Dylan Scott, and performances by local drag artists. Moore told Vice that it was probably the first time people had seen a drag show in their life.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 3rd, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
At the beginning, I was pretty confident, and then by the end, I felt like he was having serious doubts about his capacity to make a decision about this case in our favor.
Canadian activists waited months to find out how it would end, but you'll hear the decision in British Columbia's 2001 marriage equality case later in the program. ABC TV's sexy suspense crime drama How to Get Away with Murder boasts television's only Asian gay character, Oliver Hampton. Oliver has a lot in common with the actor who plays him, Human Rights Campaign Visibility Award winner Conrad Rickamora. He accepted the honor at an August 27th gala in Cleveland, Ohio.
Everything has its season, everything has its time. Show me a reason and I'll soon show you a rhyme. Cats fit on the windowsill, children fit in the snow. Why do I feel I don't fit in anywhere I go? Rivers belong where they can ramble. Eagles belong where they can fly. I've got to be where my spirit can run free. Gotta find my corner of the sky.
It's a little ironic to be getting the Visibility Award because so much of growing up as a kid was spent trying to be invisible. I grew up in Niceville, Florida, which, if you're not familiar, is right below Alabama. It was rough, not only being gay, but having the color skin that I have. So I was terrified that someone would see me as gay, and I was also terrified that I would see myself for what I naturally was. Growing up, like so many people in rural, conservative areas of the world, I was taught by my environment that there was something wrong with me. And years of shame build up, and they weigh you down, and they make you want to hide. But eventually, I left that small town of Niceville, Florida, and moved to a bigger town and a bigger world. And I realized that I wasn't alone, and a lot of it is because of the amazing groups like HRC that are providing so much necessary help for LGBTQ people. And I saw people on the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, where I moved for undergrad, and then Philly, where I lived and worked for about 4 years, and New York City, of course, where people just live their lives happily and openly. And as I got older, I started seeing LGBTQ characters in the media being created by brave writers, actors, and studio executives. So I'm happy to be playing Oliver and to be providing that visibility now for not only for gay men, but also for gay men of color and HIV-positive people. I want to thank Pete Nowak for creating How to Get Away with Murder, who also lives his life as a proud, openly gay man. and for creating two incredibly real and complex characters in Connor and Oliver, and for showing sex between two guys on primetime network TV. It's really exciting to be a part of something that's normalizing and representing what has already existed in the world since forever, and letting people all over the world know that there's nothing wrong with who you're attracted to. And of course, I have to thank Shonda Rhimes, just for letting it exist in the universe that is Shondaland, and just for being such a badass in life in general. She's amazing. And most importantly, I want to thank my parents. It's not so easy growing up gay, but it's also probably challenging to have a child who's figuring out what it's like to grow up gay, and so I want to thank my stepmom, Debbie, who, when I wrote her a letter in college because I was too scared to call. But I sent it to her work because I wanted her to get it first and then talk to my dad. But the first thing that she wrote back to me was, "It's okay." And then the second thing was, "It's more important for you to be who you are than to try to be what you think other people expect you to be." My dad became a single parent when I was 7 months old. My mom left, and she told me a story about when she and my dad were their first date. And on their second date, he took us all hiking, and me and my brother, I have an older brother, we were up playing ahead, and they were trailing behind, and they were talking, and he looked at her and said, "Do you think you can tell if a child is gay?" referring to me. And she said, "Well, I'm not sure, but would it matter?" And he said, "No, I just want to know if I need to be doing anything to help him." And that's when she said she fell in love with him. And this was coming from a man who was a single parent, and he was also in the military. So thanks, Dad. Thanks for providing me the space and acceptance to grow into who I am. Thanks.
With his human rights campaign Visibility Award in hand, How to Get Away with Murder's Conrad Riccamora will become a series regular when the third season of the popular ABC TV show begins later this month. Some historical perspective on Canada's queerest epoch after this important message. You're listening to This Way Out, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org.
I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage.
That's the story of This Way Out's veteran Vancouver correspondent Heather Kitching, as told in her award-winning CITR documentary Queer Decade, 1995 to 2005. In recent weeks, we've heard Heather recall the legal battles that established LGBT rights, redefined the meaning of spouse, and ended censorship by Canadian customs agents. In part four, the news may not be as good, but the spirit of the movement is strong.
Going to the chapel and we're going to get married.
2001, the battle for full legal marriage rights for same-sex couples finally came to the fore. 8 BC couples had launched a court case seeking full marriage equality. There were similar cases going forward in Ontario and Quebec. Lawyers argued the case in the BC Supreme Court in August of 2001. What you're about to hear is a rather tongue-in-cheek recap of that hearing. One of the couples threw a party at their house after it wrapped up. I interviewed people while they were, shall we say, unwinding. The first voice you'll hear belongs to Dave Short, one half of one of the couples suing for marriage. The other guy with a New Zealand accent is John Fisher. He was the executive director of EGAL.
First of all, like, what's your impression of how the case went?
I have my doubts. At the beginning, I was pretty confident that the judge took the position that marriage was up for debate, and then by the end I felt like he was having serious doubts about his capacity to make a decision about this case in our favor.
I concur.
Really?
Yeah, really. No, okay, you want me to elaborate, don't you? I can tell.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that this is, in fact, an easy case. All we're doing is coming to the court and asking the judge to apply the law. We've won this case already on the issue of the application of the constitutional principle to same-sex relationships. There are previous cases from the Supreme Court that are directly on point that say definitions of spouse which exclude us cannot be justified. The arguments that have been raised by the government, by the interveners, are the same old arguments we've heard for years. There's nothing new here. They used to come to court and say spouse is inherently heterosexual, it involves procreation, heterosexual units need to be maintained in society or else chaos will follow. They said all the same things in this hearing, except they just substituted the word marriage for the word spouse. And yet, while we've won, I think, on the legal principles previously, there is something about the institution of marriage which still strikes at the hearts and minds of some heterosexuals as something which is just a big social institution that can't be changed. Obviously, the scale of the issue is not relevant for constitutional or legal purposes. The judge still has a responsibility to apply the charter, apply the law, and find in our favor. Nonetheless, I think that the interveners against us were successful in essentially creating concerns within the judge about what he's being asked to do, and that creates concerns with us that he may be influenced by that and find against us. But, of course, all that remains to be seen.
How did you feel about the performance of all of the different lawyers who were acting in favor of the petitioners?
Well, all our team was great. The others, I wasn't persuaded at all. I thought the AG of Canada was silly, and the interveners against us were just offensive. That's my summary. Do you want me to elaborate on that at all?
If you could, that would be great.
Okay. Well, the Attorney General of Canada was not terribly persuasive. For me, one of the memorable moments of the hearing was when she described heterosexual procreation as the historical purpose of marriage rather than the historical purpose. And, of course, we were rolled with laughter, and the judge acknowledged that many people would probably agree with her that this was a historical purpose.
And what did you guys think of the judge in the case?
Well, I think if he finds in our favor, he's great. If he finds against us, then clearly there are fundamental points that he's not grasped.
So we'll see whether what we think about him until the ruling.
That's right.
If he doesn't find in our favor, what happens from here? Can we appeal?
Mass suicide.
Thank you, Dave. Or that is one option, as Dave has identified. The other alternative is we could appeal, and I think probably that is what we'll be recommending to our clients.
The decision came down from the courts less than 3 months later. This is another one of the litigants in the case. Her name is Tanya Chambers.
I was checking my email at a little, like, 24-hour 7-Eleven type store, and when I found, oh, bad news, we lost. So it wasn't exactly a great day. I was frustrated and angry and sad, and I think the thing that hit me the most is I took it a lot more personal than I thought I would. That it wasn't just an attack on gay couples, that it was like, you're not good enough. Your relationship, even though we're discriminating against you, it doesn't matter. You're not good enough to deserve to be married.
Before I cry. If losing the marriage case was a blow to the community, what happened next was much, much worse. In November of 2001, word went out that a man had been murdered in Stanley Park. 41-year-old Aaron Webster had been swarmed by a group of young men who beat him with baseball bats and pool cues. They found him in a gay cruising area. Anti-gay assaults had been going on in the West End for years. A gay park board commissioner named Duncan Wilson had been beaten in 1996. The murder of Aaron Webster became like a focal point for the community's rage. The day after it happened, Jim Diva, the co-owner of Little Sisters, organized a march and rally. This is him speaking.
Society has somehow begun to accept us. The polls are going up in our favor. But yet this violence continues. It's like we've lived in a state of terrorism since we've come out. And I think it's time that we say that we will not put up with this terrorism anymore. We will not be looking behind our shoulders to see if there's a gang of young men out there to kill us.
The police charged four men with Webster's murder. Three were convicted. But remember that sentencing legislation that the government passed back in 1995? The one that allowed judges to hand down stiffer sentences for hate crimes against minorities? Well, the Crown never asked for it. And that led to more outrage.
The outrage goes to school in part five of Queer Decade.
In April of 97, I put forward some books for district approval about same-gender families, and they banned them.
The Chief Justice of the court said tolerance is always age-appropriate.
The Surrey School Board struggle is remembered when the saga of Canada's LGBT push for equality continues on This Way Out.
Queer Decade 1995 to 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jessica Andrea, Wenzel Jones, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Check out the latest program information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Contact FM, Hamilton, New Zealand, Experiment FM, Ames, Iowa, Grateful Dread Public Radio, Nashville, Tennessee, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.